everybody, and welcome to the Aggieville Alleycast podcast. Look, I'm rain, shine, or anything in between. We're here to deliver to you the Kansas State sporting news you so love. I'm Ace Edwards, right alongside
Connor Baltazor.
And welcome to this week's weekly recap, where we're going to go over transfer portal news, both exits and entrances, I guess.
Entrance?
I guess it works. It works either way. But before we get started, I want to thank the supporter of this show, that is Greg Arthur. And if you want to support the show financially, please be sure to check out the supporters link, where you can donate as little as $1 per month. And it really helps keep the show running and going. But to begin with the exit from Kansas State men's basketball, that would be Jarrell Colbert, who you and I were high on the potential of. But he was just such a volatile player in his time here, even though he is a former four-star, former five-star even. But, you know, it is a shame. It always is a shame to lose a player with such high potential. But, you know, we ride, basically.
Yeah, I was disappointed to see Jarrell go, because I liked Jarrell, and I think you put it well. The potential of Jarrell was really intriguing, because he hasn't made a huge impact statistically yet. His athletic presence got him into the starting lineup in the latter half of the year, and he was generally a good defender, if a little foul happy. So often his minutes were pretty limited for that reason. But still, he was somebody that I think, if he had developed a bit more, I think could have been a really interesting piece. But unfortunately in the portal now, so there's good and bad to take from that. It's another spot for sending to try and get a guy that maybe would have been of Jarrell Colbert's like ceiling caliber. There's plenty of bigs in the portal that I'm sure that we're chasing right now. But for now, though, we do already have one exciting portal commit.
Yeah. And that is the former Michigan guard, Doug McDaniel, from the Washington, D.C. area. And this is one that is really exciting for a lot of reasons. Not only because he's generally a pretty good player, but also it's helped for a backcourt that, you know, next year will be pretty young, with the exception of Quez Glover, at least as it stands right now. So to me, this was a big pickup for that reason alone. But it helps that I think by near consensus, Doug McDaniel was at least a top 15 player in the transfer portal. If I remember correctly, some even had him top 10 by the time he committed. But yeah, this is a massive pickup. And Connor, you can go into his stats and more his general game. But.
And yeah, I think it was Rivals. He was maybe number 4, I think. But he was consensus top 15, it seems like. But Doug McDaniel, he averaged last season in his second year of college basketball 16.3 points per game, and he did that on 41% from the field, 36.8% from three, and then 77.4% at the line. So a fairly decent shooter. And then he added 3.7 rebounds, which is a little bit more than I guess you'd think for a 5'11", 175 point guard. Then 4.7 assists to 2.4 turnover, so about a 2-to-1 assist to turnover ratio. And given that he was one of very few conscious basketball players on Michigan's team, it's pretty impressive. I don't really worry too much about Michigan not being good. I think that was a pretty significant coaching issue.
Yeah, especially given the talent that they've been able to bring in, weirdly enough.
Yeah, they've been a phenomenally talented program that just has been a little rudderless lately. But Doug McDaniel, this was his second year playing. He started 26 games each season, although he played in 8 more as a freshman. So as a true freshman, he was already pretty good. But he nearly doubled his scoring output this season. He's well on pace to 1,000 points in his career. He's at 717 after just 2 years. But he's a very dynamic scorer, and he can score in a lot of ways. I think a lot of people will draw comparisons to Marquise Noel in some ways. I think that there is some truth to that in terms of his explosiveness, and he's also a very good passer. Marquise is very special, and I don't think there's anyone really like him. But Doug does have some similar qualities. I'd say he's closer to Marquise than Tyler Perry, and I don't think it's really close either. He's a much better mover than Tyler Perry. His defensive rating wasn't very good last season, but granted, nobody's on Michigan was very good. That's why they went like 8-26 or whatever, because they just didn't play good team defense. Although his freshman year, his defensive rating was a lot better. But Doug McDaniel, he has a great outside shooting game, near 80% at the free throw line, so that is indicative of a good shooter. But he's also pretty crafty around the rim as well, which you have to be when you're his size. But he has a floater game, which is something that Marquise Noel, I think people credit him with, but he didn't actually really do a lot of.
Except for in the tournament.
Yeah, it was just kind of in that tournament. He has a kind of similar mid-range game that Marquise had, where he can just, you know, use in a pinch. I know Marquise had a couple of step back mid-range jumpers in the tournament. But Doug, he has a pretty nice floater off the glass. And he's also pretty good at getting to the rim for an easy layup as well. But he is able to score multiple levels. Probably a score first point guard. There's not a lot of true pure point guards, but he's a ball handler is the most impressive thing about him. And that's, I think, really what we were really lacking this year, is Tyler Perry was a great basketball player, but that's just not who he is. He just wasn't a ball handler. He was a two. He was a shooting guard at North Texas, and we were asking him to really do something different. That's why Day-Day was starting and playing as much towards the end of the year, was because we just needed someone that was better at ball handling. But Doug McDaniel, he's a fantastic ball handler, very good at facilitating offense, and he's really fast as well, really pesky. This is the sort of guard I think that the staff has really started to gravitate towards, is undersized guys that can make offense happen for others or on their own. I'm very, very happy with this pickup. And the most impressive thing I think about it all is that, unlike last year where we had to wait a while and we kind of were going through, you know, we had A. Smith on the board and then we didn't, and then we had Estrada on the board and then we didn't, this is the staff's first pick. Tyler Perry was a little later on, and I think he was still a good take, but Doug is, it seems, the staff's first choice in a point guard, and we closed very quickly on Doug McDaniel. We did not wait for the dead period and then let that extend out. No, we fended off some stiff competition from TCU and some schools from the Washington, D.C. area, and locked it down really quickly.
Yeah, and I think that's the most impressive part, is just how quickly we were able to get it done and get that first piece from the portal. Because now, if memory serves, we have four spots to work with, including David Castillo. So, you know, you and I have our own personal wish lists. I think the backcourt is mostly fine as it stands right now. Maybe if it's a best player available scenario, grab another one, but I think what we need right now is front court more than anything else, especially because we have one big question mark on the roster.
We have, what, Dave and
Dave
Taj?
Dave and Buddy?
Taj.
Taj.
So three, but you only have one that's got starting experience. So definitely need, I think, at least two bigs. But there should be plenty of opportunity for that. We hosted Terrace Reed on a visit. He's another Michigan guy. Somebody that Bruce Weber recruited out of high school. And so he's familiar with K-State. And, of course, former teammate of Doug McDaniel, so they're familiar with each other as well. So he's somebody that may end up being a Wildcat, but there's plenty of other big names out there right now as well. Clifford the Big Red Dog from Rutgers?
Rutgers.
Yes, I can never remember if it's Rutgers or St. John's, but he's an East Coast guy, and he's high up on everyone on Earth's wish list, so fingers crossed at least. But other than that, there's more and more names going in every single day. I've heard rumors that Ryan Kalkbrenner at Creighton might be headed to the portal. TBD on that, although I think if he leaves Creighton, he knows where he's going. which probably won't be us. But there's still going to be more and more developments. But I'm glad the staff is being a little bit more proactive this year. And I get last year they wanted to be, you know, choosy and didn't want to rush to a decision. But we also don't want to pass up a good option when it's right there. And they did not. So
yeah. And what I'll leave off on is for any like immediate portal news, obviously you have the obvious on three follows, but go subscribe to KSO. They do amazing work.
Yeah, if you're impatient like we are and you need to know everything before it happens, that's the place to be.
Yeah, they all do excellent work. Voth, Galloway, Young, all of them do great work, both on the boards and on the, you know, when they actually write articles as well. But that is the basketball recruiting news. Now we can go into the Batcats, which is our final segment of the day as well. But actually, before we do that, two quick mentions. Congratulations to Gabby Gregory for being named to the Women's College Basketball All-Star Team, as well as, briefly, for Batcats news, they released a top 45 for the Golden Spikes Award, which is the best player in college baseball. Brady Day ended up in that watch list for K-State. He was the only person on K-State that was on that watch list. But still, that's, given that he's batting, what, like 406 or like 402, something like that?
Yeah, it's something absurd like that. I think the thing that's most impressive about Brady Day right now is that his batting average in conference play is actually higher than his non-conference, which is just even funnier, I think.
Yeah. Congratulations to both Gabby Gregory and Brady Day. But now we can get into the weekend series the K-State had up against Texas. The first game went our way. The last two very much didn't. This was not really a game of... This was not really a series of consistency. There were two lopsided victories and then a... Well, the last game looks more lopsided than it actually was, even though it doesn't look terrible. But just starting with the first game, was a 14-6 K-State victory. Texas made it look more respectable than it actually was with three garbage time runs in the ninth. But, you know, this was a game where Texas ended up scoring first and scoring quickly with two home runs in the first two innings, one of which being a two-run bomb. And then K-State responded with eight runs in the second. And from then, it was basically all K-State until garbage time. But this was... There are a few notable things to come out of this game. I'll cover the offensive numbers. Pretty much everyone got a hit. In fact, the only person who did not get a hit that is credited are pitchers and also a defensive sub. Chuck Ingram ended up going 3-for-5 with a home run and two strikeouts. Brendan Jones ended up going 1-for-5 with a run and a walk. Brady Day, 2-for-4 with a walk and a strikeout, and a double to go alongside that. Nick English, 2-for-4, 3 RBI. Kalen Culpepper, I skipped him, 2-for-4 with 3 RBI, including a home run. Kyan Lotus, 2-for-4, 2 RBI with a home run. Daniel Rivera, 1-for-4 with an RBI and a run on a one walk. Rafi, 1-for-4 with a walk. And then, weirdly enough, the coming out party for David Bishop going 4-for-5 with 3 runs, 1 RBI on a home run. That is his, I believe that's his first home run in a K-State uniform.
Yeah, it was. And he'd had in his time at TCU, had a few home runs, but he hadn't had one yet at K-State. Had it a few times recently, started to get some fly balls that were kind of making their way to the warning track, which was better than what we'd been seeing. So it's kind of been a gradual progression for him, but finally broke through in this game and really had a fantastic performance.
Yeah, there's no really poor offensive performances here.
Yeah, and that really is a huge credit to how they played, particularly in the second inning, because we knocked out Texas's starting pitcher after just one plus innings. LeBaron Johnson, the preseason Big 12 pitcher of the year, gave up 6 earned on just 9 batters faced. So really, 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 really fantastic stuff from the K-State offense. And then K-State's pitching staff was really quality on their own. Josh Wintrobe is credited with the W in this one. Goes 5 1/3, 6 hits, 3 earned runs, a walk, and 5 strikeouts. So he really brought things under control after the first 2 innings. Only 72 pitches as well. Adam Arthur went 2 2/3 with a walk and a strikeout. Did hit a batter, no hits. And then Mason Buss came in for the final inning. Did give up some garbage time runs, so gave up his first earned run of the year. 4 hits, 3 earned, got a strikeout. So a little messy for Mason Buss there at the end. But he still closes out the game, and K-State started the series really well.
Yeah, that gave us quite a bit of confidence. Then the next game happened, which was a 21-11 victory for Texas. The big story for this one was the 3 errors for K-State. It seems like every couple of weeks, K-State's due for a game where just they can't get out of their own way. And this is, to me, the definition of not being able to get out of your own way. And that's despite, we put up 11 runs. That's despite some pretty solid offensive performances.
Yeah. Chuck Ingram went 3 for 5 with 3 RBI. And this one, he had 2 home runs and a double. Really, really great for him. Brennan Jones did have a rough day going 0 for 5. So not the best day. Brady Day going 2 for 5. Kalen Culpepper went 3 for 5 and added a home run of his own. Nick English, 0 for 5 with 2 strikeouts. Same stat line as Brendan. Kyan Lotus, 1 for 3. Big day for him with a triple. Drew a walk as well. Then Daniel Rivera, 1 for 3 with 3 RBI and drew a walk. And Jaden Parsons went 1 for 1. Rafael Pelletier quietly went 3 for 3 with a home run and drew a walk. Mason Schwalbach got a hit late in the game. He pinch hit near the end. Then David Bishop, he had a sack fly and drew a walk and had 2 RBI, but still went 0 for 2. So a bit of a strange day for him. But yeah, the errors were what just destroyed K-State. And it was all pitchers and catchers on the errors. And Pelletier gets credited with 1, probably should have been credited with 2.
Maybe even 3.
Yeah. And then Blake Dean gets 1 and Jackson Wentworth gets 1. Just really, really, really brutal stuff that you can't even put on the fielders. It's going to hurt K-State's fielding percentage, but that shows why fielding percentage is kind of a bad stat. Is because it's, you know, just a couple of guys. It's not the infield and outfield that's really doing it. This was a really a great game for a while. It was back and forth and high scoring and really high energy for a while. And K-State would push and Texas would push back. And then Texas just blew it up at the very end of the game.
Yeah. And there weren't many good pitching performances by K-State. Jacob Frost goes 3 2/3, ends up giving 6 runs, 7 of them earned, only 3 strikeouts, no walks. Blake Dean goes 2 1/3, 2 hits to 1 run. It's counted as an unearned run, but it's his own error that caused it. 4 strikeouts, 1 wild pitch. Jack Wentworth looked mortal, which was scary. 7 hits, 6 runs, 2 of them earned. Again, maybe all 6 of them should have been earned because he had a throwing error as well. But 4 strikeouts, 1 walk. Andrew Evans comes in for 2/3 of an inning, gets blown up for 7 runs, and by then the game's over. Preston Martinez comes in, goes 1/3 of an inning, 1/3 of an inning, gives up a hit and strikes someone out.
Yeah, pretty brutal stuff from the pitching staff after what had been a pretty solid Thursday night. But yeah, Wentworth's worst outing of the year. Real regression from Jacob Frost. Blake Dean had a pretty solid outing on his own. Was really the only K-State pitcher to be effective against Texas. Jackson Wentworth started well, but then really just lost a handle of things after a little bit.
Yeah, which he's not the only one to do that, so it's not like we're not trying to dogpile on him. He's been amazing this year. But yeah, it just wasn't his day. And sometimes as a pitcher, you have those days. As a pitcher, I had those days. It was every third start. But the last game, the rubber match, ended up going Texas's way 6-3. K-State actually did end up mounting a comeback to make it a one-run game in the eighth, but it ended up coming short with Texas extending their lead by 2 runs in the last inning. This was another frustrating game, I think is probably the best way to describe it. Just offensively, I mean, there are a few decent performances. Chuck Ingram going 3-for-5 with an RBI, Brendan Jones 3-for-5. Brady Day collecting the rare ofer. Kalen Culpepper only going 1-for-5. And Kyan Lotus going 1-for-4, scoring a run, as well as Rafael Pelletier ended up walking and scoring a run. David Bishop ends up getting 2 hits with an RBI. So, I mean, offensively, you know, 3 runs. Sometimes there was an old baseball coach that I had that said, 3 runs, or if you're giving up 3 runs or less, it's basically an offensive skill issue. If you're giving up 5 runs or more, it's a defensive skill issue. I never learned what happens if you scored 4, but this was a really frustrating game, again, defensively. Owen Borma, I don't want to step on your toes, but technically this is fielding. Owen Borma, he hasn't been himself, I think is probably the best way to say it. I think he's pressing, and that's the worst thing that you can do as a pitcher, is just start pressing and start saying, like, the moment that you as a pitcher start treating situations differently or outings differently, just from a purely attitudinal standpoint, that's when you're going to develop a lot of consistency issues. So basically what I'm saying is that as a pitcher, you have to treat it the same way as if you're pitching up against, I don't know, like Stonehill, than you are pitching against Arkansas, at least mentally. And it seems like Borma just is pressing a little bit, and that kind of showed with how he was playing defensively and also the massive trouble he kept getting himself into.
Yeah, it was a tough day for Borma, particularly on the errors. Pitching-wise, he honestly wasn't that bad. Actually, he was quite good, just purely pitching. But he was only credited with 2 earned runs on 4 runs given up. But again, that's another situation where those unearned runs were because of Owen Borma's errors. He had a horrible throw to first, and then a throw that was so bad that I actually started laughing, which it takes a lot for me to become so sad about K-State that it goes from despair to laughter. But it was about a probably 15-foot throw, maybe 20, from wherever he was at on a bunt to home, and he just
a bit outside.
Completely misses. He was definitely erratic in this one, but he controlled for the most part when he did have rough starts. Like, he hit 3 batters, he walked 4. A very unusual for K-State pitchers. Normally when we're giving up runs, it's just dingers. So,
especially in Toyton.
Yeah, especially in Toyton. But this was kind of a weird wind today. Especially early, I feel like the wind was really blowing in. But Borma, just 99 pitches. But yeah, this... He cost us this game. Like, we had plenty of offensive opportunities, but we probably win if he just puts a throw in the right spot twice.
Yeah.
Granted, Tyson Nabors, he had an uncharacteristic outing as well. He went 3 innings, only 2 hits, but those 2 hits were back-to-back solo home runs. And just absolutely back-breaking. 3 strikeouts, 1 walk. Really tough stuff in his first outing of the season in Toyton. Just brutal. Really brutal way to drop the series. A very winnable series at that. This was a series where every game, despite the scoreline in game 2, we really had a very legitimate chance of winning that. But pitching really did us in. in those last two games. Because even when Texas wasn't hitting, or when they weren't getting on base, when they made contact, it was loud.
Yeah, they were banging it.
Yeah, they were... Pause. They were just destroying pitches. Luckily, for a while, it was just being hit directly at people. But, I mean, they were just batting better than we were. It was just an athlete's thing, I think, with that. And our pitching just, you know, despite the really good performance night one from Wintrib, we just kind of got in our own way with pitching.
Yeah.
There should have been a series that we won. Frankly, it's a series that we had the potential to sweep, but instead we drop it 1-2.
Yeah. And you and I said that the line for us to be, like, happy with left-on-base numbers is 7. There was 11 this game. So, again, we had the opportunities. Just sometimes we just didn't capitalize on them. And I think it's one thing to me if we're just, like, we get outright dominated and only have one or two opportunities and we don't capitalize on them. But it's consistently getting, you know, an opportunity every inning and a half, give or take, or every two innings, and then just not capitalizing on any of them. That's when I start to get a little bit annoyed.
Yeah, leaving the bases juiced again in a high-leverage situation, it has kind of become a tradition unlike any other for this team. Oddly enough, we're really good with two outs, but not if the bases are loaded.
Yeah.
If we have two on, one on, that's fine. But if the bases are loaded, we basically just have to hope to draw a walk.
Yeah.
Because we can do that. We can draw a walk, but we are just not clearing the bases when they're loaded very often, it feels like. Just not hitting super well in those situations for some reason. But I'm not going to harp on the hitting too much. Because I feel like that's just not been the problem so far. It's mostly been pitching, which is weird, because I do think that we have pitching talent. I think that we're just not locating the way that we need to at the moment, which I don't know if that's a pitcher's thing or something else, but I won't speculate too much on here. I'm not in the dugout, so.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was the Texas series. K-State did end up bouncing back in a midweek game up against Missouri State. Ended up winning 8-4, although it wasn't without its sweaty moments towards the middle part of the game. Blake Dean ended up getting the start, and it was a pretty hot start offensively for K-State, scoring in each of the first two innings, you know, one of which was a KC single, and then another was... Let me flip the order here. Brady Day scoring on a wild pitch, as well as Brendan Jones, and then Nick English scoring Brady Day. And then Kalen Culpepper in the second scoring Day and Pelletier in a single. So it was a pretty quick start offensively for the Cats.
Yeah. Kalen Culpepper is the banner guy out of this game. He went 3-for-4, drew a walk. I think he was a double off of the cycle.
He was a double off the cycle.
Yeah. So... a really, really good day for him. Really looked like the Kalen Culpepper that we've been expecting. He's kind of picked it up these last few games. Drew a walk as well. But going top to bottom, a lot of players played in this game. We saw a lot of faces in this game. I think particularly early, I think we thought that we were just going to coast after the first couple innings. And then we let them back in, and then we locked in again, and then we... ended up winning. But Chuck Ingram had a brutal day. 0-for-6 with 4 strikeouts. Sub-optimal day for Chuck. Brendan Jones, 1-for-4, draws a walk. Brady Day, 1-for-2 with 3 runs, which is just funny to see.
3 walks as well.
3 walks. So it's just average Brady Day. Nick English bounces back. He had a really rough go of it in the latter part of the Texas series. He had a great first game, then talked some smack in an interview, and then went 0-for-8 for the rest of the series.
He learned baseball karma exists. Yes,
that's a teachable moment for the young freshman. And he I wasn't able to watch this game, but he did get injured trying to leg out a single, right?
Yeah, he tweaked his ankle.
Yeah.
That's why Lotus moved to right. We had two people get hurt this game. We'll talk about the other one, though.
Yeah. Nick English of 2-for-3 in RBI for him. Daniel Rivera playing third. He subbed into this game. He drew a walk and scored a run. And then Jaden Parsons started to third, moved to first. He went 1-for-4, had 3 strikeouts, though. David Bishop was a defensive sub late. Kyan Lotus, 0-for-2, but 3 walks for him. Mason Schwalbach got his first start, I think. 0-for-5, 3 strikeouts, but did get an RBI. Rafael Pelletier, 0-for-2, drew a run, or got a run, and drew a walk. And Caden Carl, he
pinch ran.
And then Caden Phillips went 0-for-2 with a strikeout.
Yeah, he also caught a bat to the side of his head.
Yeah, I think I remember seeing our tweet about that. I was wondering what happened there.
The Missouri State batter, I think, was standing a bit too far back in the box, or maybe Caden Phillips was too far forward. I don't know. The angle wasn't really conclusive on it. But on the follow-through, the gap between the old-school catcher's mask, I don't know. I guess I'm demonstrating just for Connor. But like between the old-school catcher's mask and like the bill or like the old hat, bat caught him right there, like right above his eye.
Oh.
And he ended up having to come out of the game. He did return, but he had to get gauzed up because he was bleeding. Like, so it caught him pretty solidly.
Ouch. Well, glad he's all right then. Because, yeah, that sounds pretty scary.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily fun. It was a scary time, but he ended up being fine. He's a tough guy. Ended up just gauzing it up and was fine. But in terms of pitchers, take your pick. There's a lot of them.
Yeah, quite the list.
Blake Dean gets a start, goes 2, only gives up 1 hit, no earned runs, 1 strikeout. Sam Roberts comes in for 2/3 of an inning, hits a guy, and then forces 2 outs. Cole Weisenbaker goes 2 innings, 2 hits, 1 earned, 2 walks, and a strikeout. He was with a hit batter. He was a bit shaky this game. Adam Arthur, 2/3 of an inning, 1 hit, 2 earned runs, 1 walk. Again, like the middle part of this game was pretty shaky in terms of bullpen arms. Preston Martinez ends up going 1, he ends up getting 0, so 0 plus, and then goes with 1 earned run. Jack actually was the one in while that run scored, just got credited to him. Jack goes 1 2/3, 2 hits, 1 walk, 3 strikeouts. Mason Buss comes in, sort of calms everything down, which he seemed to be done really good at. When we just need a steady, like, calm down, don't let yourself get too amped up kind of guy. Mason Buss has been that guy. 2 strikeouts, only 1 walk, doesn't give up any hits. Then Tyson Neighbors comes in, walks a guy, and then proceeds to strike out the other 3. So that
is the most Tyson Neighbors outing of all time.
Well, if it was freshman Tyson Neighbors, he would have walked the bases loaded and then struck out for 3 guys.
This is maturing Tyson Neighbors. We only need to walk 1. But he just gets better with runners on base. I don't get it.
Yeah. Maybe it's a mentality thing. I don't know. But weirdly enough, despite the fact that there are so many pitchers used, there wasn't an abnormal amount of pitches thrown. Only 157. I think it's because Preston Martinez only threw 3 and Sam Roberts only threw 5. But, yeah, it was the only complaint that I had with this game is I kind of wanted to see Blake Dean go longer, but I think we're saving him for the series up against the newly ranked UCF team. We really want him to be that sort of middle relief guy to either open the door for Wentworth or Neighbors to close out the game. So I understand why we didn't have him go much deeper, but to me that just raises the question of, you know, why not throw Evans, Buss, there's another name I'm thinking of. I forgot it. Anyway, but, you know, why not throw Buss or Evans out there? I mean, you and I think, shared our theory about Mason Buss last week, where we're trying to, like, save him towards the back end of the year so most people don't get a good scout on him. But, you know, this game got scary, but it ended up being a pretty comfortable victory. Now K-State has a massive series down in Orlando up against the ranked 25th in the country, UCF. And I believe they're, like, top 5 in RPI.
Yeah, they're ranked fairly highly in the RPI. They are 6. So very close. But yeah, they're very highly regarded. Then have a return home game against Wichita State the following Wednesday. So from the day this releases, it'll be 5 days. But yeah, big series against UCF. People I know, I'm myself included, kind of melting down a bit after some of those Texas games. But at the end of the day, it is baseball. You're going to lose games, and you're going to have games where you just look really bad. That's just going to happen. Unfortunately, it's against Texas because I'd prefer they get nothing nice. But, you know, it is what it is. But still, if the season ended today, this is a baseball team that is in the field, I think. And, I think they've been projected into the Florida or the Gainesville and the Fayetteville regionals.
Which as I would a two prefer seed. If we don't end up in the Fayetteville regional.
Yeah, I would much prefer that. I'd rather not have to witness that. But, so this is still a lot of work to do, still a lot of season left. But we are in a pretty decent spot.
Yeah. My expectations are to get at least one down in Orlando. If you can end up picking up the series, that's massive for RPI. That probably moves us. We're like 33rd. We're in there. If we win the series, we probably move up into high to mid 20s.
Yeah.
For RPI. So this is a massive series, but it's also possible that if we just manage to pick up one, we either don't move down or move up like a spot or two.
Yeah. Really just depends on what the teams around us do. And also, if we do lose a couple games, just the margins, we just need to put a respectable product out on the field is mainly what we need to do. If we're losing, just don't lose big, which we haven't made a habit of doing this year. That's really only happened twice, and that's just been two games just really got out of control. That's Tennessee and Texas. So I'm not sure what to expect yet. From UCF, but I'm hoping that the team is kind of reset. They seem to have reset for that Missouri State game, particularly early. They seemed really locked in, but we'll see. It's a big road series, and need to just keep building their resume. This will be a 3 quad 1 opportunities.
Yeah. That pretty much wraps up all the news segment. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I don't.
Well, if that's the case, thank you all for listening to this episode of the Aggieville Alley Cats podcast. If you want to follow or contact the show, you can follow us just about anywhere at AggievilleACats. And if you want to email us, we're AggievilleAlleyCats@gmail.com. If you want to follow us more personally, I'm at ACEdward00.
I'm at Connor Baltazor, capital C, capital B.
And if you want to support the show financially, please, once again, be sure to check out the official Aggieville Alley Cats merch store, as well as the supporters link, both in our Twitter and podcast bios. But most importantly, thank you all for listening to this episode of the Aggieville Alley Cats podcast. Where come rain, shine, or anything between, we're here to deliver to you the Kansas State sporting news that you so love. Stay safe, Alley Cats.